Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Adrienne King, the co-host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Jay Dodd about her new book, The Black Condition, featuring Narcissus. Welcome to the show, Jay.
What's up? Hi.
So first of all, I want to say that I really loved your book. I actually read it twice because I thought it was so good. So I was wondering if you could start by just telling us a little bit about yourself and about your work.
One, thank you so much for having me. I am so excited to share about this work. But about myself, my name is Jay Dodd. I am a writer and an artist. I was born in Los Angeles, California. I've since lived across, mostly on the East Coast for the last decade, in between Connecticut and Boston. I went to college in Boston and I studied sociology, where I started as an internet essayist, in terms of my serious writing. And then I got over that shit real quick, and turned to poetry and more creative writing. And I've just been working in the creative arts field, both creatively and professionally, basically since 2015-16. And so I recently moved to Portland to launch the Duff Song Labs, the new branch of Winter Tangerine that does salons and workshops. I'm just basically avoiding an MFA by giving everyone else all the skills that I have been acquiring.
Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship to poetry?
Sure. So my mom is a poet and a writer first. So any conversation about my work begins with my mother, as my favorite conversations always do. But my mom is also a minister by trade, and also she's one of the ministers since she was a child. Her writing has been for the scholarly, for the meditative, and also straight up just a poet. As a child, I was exposed to the poetry scene in LA through her. I grew apart from it. I was interested in other things at the time, dance, theater, just whatever. After a long life of dance and theater, I had to do something else. I was writing in college to sort of just like deal with being on the internet and wanting to have a voice. After incident with the police, I had to stop dancing. So I really had to reevaluate my relationship to art. And so I started to be in community with in a slam community in Boston. And then I released a rap album, and then I just fully dipped and totally turned into a full on poet. And then since then I've expanded into other genres, but the act of poetry, both as a performance and as a written work, definitely is like a main frequency that I rely on. But it as an industry frustrates me. It as a limited genre frustrates me. Poets piss me off, but poetry as a concept, I will absolutely die for.
Will you say more about what your frustrations are?
Yeah. Where should I start? No, I'm kidding. No, that's unnecessary. That's unnecessary. Well, I mean, I think that because of just one being alive in this world under the systems that we have, anything we believe in gets muddled by having to be alive. Like anything we like, our intentions, our desires, we have to eat and breathe and sleep and whatever and all these other things. And so, I always have a place and understanding because I don't think that I'm by any means a perfect poet. I don't even think that that's possible. But I think that there's an urgency around performance as opposed to an urgency around thought that I think poetry both lends itself to and also makes it easier to evade necessary conversation, because a poem can look so good because a person can make a thing look so pretty, but the person is still the person and they're still in a community that is only doing so much work, or they're still only, you know, but these poems are still these poems, you know, and these poems are still these poems and still these poems, and these people are still hungry. These people are still being taught to bleed for no reason. These people are still not having their voices actually shared, but being collected and curated. So these same four or five poets can get the same four and five things. It is an ecosystem of siphoning and shit. And so, yeah. I think that it is too easy to, under the guise of community, to exploit each other and ourselves. And I think that this language that gives us so much freedom also gives us so much weaponry to cut ourselves open with. And that's just dangerous. And I don't think we think about it with intention. Only in crisis do we worry about the politics of poems, which is the last time we need it.
I'm curious, with that in mind, how you came to write this book, and maybe what you were saying too, like, how did you think about intention when like writing and publishing this book?
Well, writing this book and publishing this book have two very separate stories. Also, give me one second. A candle on my altar, like, just broke some glass. And so I'm going to just handle this real quick. It's all good. It's like a small...
Yeah.
I'm just going to... And we're great. Anyways, sorry. Apparently, I am on the verge of some shit. Anyways, that's completely both unrelated and probably related to whatever I'm about to say. So... Yeah, so the process for the Black Condition featuring Narcissus. Oh my God, I just poured water on this shit, and this flame is still going. Oh, word, wow. Sorry, I'm just I live in a place that could go up in flames, so I'm trying to make sure it's okay. Yeah. But actually, no, it's fine.
Yeah,
we're fine.
We can pause if you want to take care of it.
No, it's out. Sorry, we're good.
Sorry.
I'm very sensitive to it, but also never afraid of it, and we're good now. So. This book began, also I have a full-on altar for everyone listening. I speak to the ancestors regularly. So this book, I started writing not knowing it was going to be this salient. Mm-hmm. I began writing Narcissus poems in a very dark place, and they were very urgent, and I just needed them. I needed to create a voice that could be possible, because there was no I could speak from and feel safe, and I knew I needed to be somewhere in my work. And so Narcissus became this really great character to just drop into, but also to look at in this reflective way. And so the Narcissus poems sort of just came in this very like river like suite over time. And then during the promotion of Manish Tongues, my first collection, I got like a weird ass message, a weird ass DM from somebody on Twitter, saying that they love Black poets, Black poets don't like them, and they're interested in the Black Condition. Like, they literally said, quote for quote, I'm interested in the Black Condition, and that shit like sent me into a spiral. And so I created that work, you know, in the days following that. It really was a coalescing of where I was, but not I didn't craft the book mm-hmm. with intention in this way. And so by the time that I saw all these Narcissus poems and this Black Condition piece so concrete. I didn't necessarily realize, but I started to gather the poems that I'd written since my first book was picked up, like not even put out, but picked up. And I heard a conversation. I heard this like general anxiety around rendering myself, this general anxiety around my body and the early parts of my transition. And so all these sort of like temples were laid there. And I felt like Narcissus was definitely the most anxious voice of this collection of voices and poems. And it made sense just, you know, to call a bitch by her name and let her have her own, you know, front soloist persona. And it's sort of funny for me now because so the book was picked up by a different press before Night Boat, and it was supposed to come out at AWP. I want to say in Tampa. I'm not sure what year but that one was. Last year. Wow, I don't know how time works. Last year. And it just, I mean, for a variety of reasons that I don't need to fucking hash out here, because I actually am so blessed with Night Boat. Like, whatever, it was a total misdirection for me at the time, but I did lose a year of both, like, intention and pouring into it, and that kind of, like, fucked me up. But I really needed the extra year to be alive. Like, I didn't realize how much I, like, for myself, needed to be just a little bit more away from it to be able to talk about it. Right now, I would not be able to talk about this book this saliently a year ago. Not truly. Like, I think I'm so grateful for where I am right now in my life, and I'm glad that I was able to get this book out of me when I did, and also have it out in the world when it needed to be. But they're very separate processes, and I'm really thankful for the universe for telling me how I needed to act. But yeah, it was built out of desperation, and then curated for sort of like a need, but even then, it was put out when it wanted to be, apparently.
Yeah. So you mentioned Narcissus, and I was wondering if you could tell kind of like that myth, and then how you thought about that character, and what was it like, kind of bringing those themes into light in your work.
For sure. So Narcissus is most known for being the base of the behavior narcissism, and it's, like, you know, often described as just like self-absorbed, vain in some capacity. Many sort of like Romantic era, Renaissance era paintings and art, European art, shows Narcissus like just like laying by a river, looking at the reflection, all like, oh, whoa, what was me? Excuse me. But the story, and the one that I reference from, I'm looking at this book that I have right here, the A.S. Klein version, Metamorphosis, book 3, the section is called When Echo Sees Narcissus. And so in this version of the tale, Narcissus is born of a mortal man and a nymph. And when they're born, the nymph takes Narcissus to the oracle. And the oracle's like, okay, cool. Your baby will live forever as long as they never see themselves. And so we've sort of loosely translated this to mean like, oh, look in the mirror, see their reflection. And that's just like not really it. There was not mirrors as we know them in Greek time, like there weren't like big old shiny just like glass mirrors. That is a very modern like thing, and even their like reflective surfaces weren't as like truly reflective as we can imagine it. It was this thing of this Narcissus can never know that they are divine. They can never know why they have this otherworldly quality. They must live among man, like as a mortal. That was the actual crutch of like what Narcissus could not know about themselves, what they could not see about themselves. And so Narcissus grows up and it's just like, you know, loved by all, blah, 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 blah. But literally like, it has this very fundamental disconnect. And whenever, and like the translation for Narcissus going to the wood is a kind of self-exiling. Narcissus would go into the wood to have time to themselves, to take a break, to decompress. And so one day they're in the wood, an echo, a nymph already cursed, already cursed with being unable to speak, only able to repeat things, and already cursed love gets caught up, swoons, tries to holler at Narcissus, all this trickery. Narcissus is running around this wood going crazy. The one place they had felt safe, they are now again manic, trying to figure out who's trying to holler at them. When Echo reveals herself, Narcissus rejects her. I don't know what you are. Where did you come from? What have you been? I've only heard my own voice. What is going on here? And so Echo begins crying. Nemesis, another demigod, is nearby, sees all this, decides Narcissus is the villain, and puts a river in Narcissus' path. And so Narcissus, trying to cross this river, looks down and gets a glimpse of themselves for the first time. And this glimpse in this moving river is what strikes them. They stop. And the myth ends with them clawing at the river, trying to see this glimpse of them again. It's not that they are so enamored with their own reflection. It is that they are trying to see, oh, what was that? What? Wait, what? What was this? And so Narcissus dies by the river and becomes the poet's daffodil, and or the Narcissus flower. And yeah, so that whole allegorical framing was just like really is very useful for me. I always have a problem believing why anyone likes me, and I was a very loved child. I was an only child. I've been like very much so cared for, and so whatever my mental, you know, health and locations are and have been, I mean, some things I know, but some things are, you know, still feel undetermined. Like, It has been so hard for me to understand why anyone fucks with me, truly, my whole life. And before I started my transition, I just like felt like, well, I don't even care because I'm gonna die soon. I really felt like I wasn't gonna like see a kind of adulthood, and so I sort of gave up on trying to figure it out. And then as I began transitioning and started to imagine life for myself, I then also had to realize, okay, so then what? So what is all this? What is all this that I have then? If not just a mean, if I'm not supposed to die by this glimpse of possibility, what else do I have for myself? And so this book was basically me doing everything to not die by the river of like my early transition and my like manic depression and like some like really, really dark times for me. But yeah, this was how I got up from that river. But that myth just spoke to me on so many allegorical levels, metaphorical levels.
Yeah, wow, that's just so cool to think about. I was wondering if you could read a poem from your book titled "We Cannot Grieve What Doesn't Leave Us, or I'll Be at Every Function," and kind of show us the connections between that poem and maybe some stuff that you just offered us.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Wow, where can is this poem? We cannot grieve what doesn't leave us, or I'll be at every function. The only man I've ever killed lived in my body. At his funeral, I'm in the back of the mezzanine wearing black jean booty shorts, oversized white t-shirt with my own face airbrushed, metallic lavender. I am his widow and his only son. Below, people are laughing, not weeping, because they are in on the joke. This cathedral tailored and fitted for a casket is a new, unspeakable familiar. Safer than mother's heels was double knot tie and monogram cufflinks. The gag is, even in rigor, the corpse smiles. The coffin is rented. The suit mine. All of this is to be burned. He never saw a need for daisies, drown his ashes in red solo cup and piss him across the clearing, a mile from the house. If a few could make the journey, if only to listen to the wind, consider that something kind. At the repast, I dance. I pink my hands in lipstick. I shift weight in seafoam skirts. There are never enough eyes to question if I'd always been here. So when someone calls for me to reveal, my trained smile mouth lifts the veil. I perform my favorite tricks again, called an apparition so often I long for the familiar ghost. My mother will tell someone how I am now divine, that she always discerned I am a conjurer. Every prayer required a sacrifice. I call this look everything I got away with. In the wake, I'm a different kind of breeze in heaven, holding whatever binds me to this earth. So yeah, whenever I read Manish Tongues, my first collection, I get like, I have to just like remember how dead and dying I felt then as a boy, and truly that is how I knew that I needed to transition, because I did not see myself living past that point, like as a man, as a boy, as like in a very specific way. I just like, and when I read it, I was like, oh, every single boy, whenever a boy appears in this poem, he dies and or is already dead and or is like being killed again. And I was like, oh wow, like you needed to get through this shit. And so when thinking about death in these new, in this work, I needed it to be a bit more fantastic and not so destined. Because we're gonna die. That's fine. Cool. Fine. But the way that I placed it, like sort of like on my lap as my thing to hold, did not feel necessary. And so how I painted the world that I was living in with the death that still sort of, you know, encompassed me, just needed to look different. And so in this poem in particular, I wanted I want to give one credit to my friend and fellow poet Casey Rocheteau, gave me a prompt for this poem. If you have many selves, write a eulogy for one of them. And so that prompt came at a time when I was navigating a more non-binariness that I don't identify with as much now. But like I was navigating a very like clear multiple selfness. And so thinking about, oh, what if I like had like a pleasurable funeral for like one of these? What if I could enjoy, like truly enjoy, because it is past, because this thing came to an end, you know? And so the thought of like looking real cute and Banji at my own funeral, you know, not having to navigate the respectability that really I thought was going to kill me, not having to I mean, my parents are both ministers. I was raised in churches. I've been to so many funerals. I have seen my body in caskets since I was a child. You know what I mean? And so it's like, what if I could go to that and not have to be what I've always been there? And then at the repast to reappear as this, you know, goddess version of this dead thing, sort of like what if every ghost, like what if every repast featured the person who just died laughing with you? That's sort of how I feel sometimes when I'm around people who like knew me then. So it is a very material rendering of how I both had to accept and hold what I killed. And also, y'all, do y'all see me now though? Do you see this? You see me, you know? Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Wow. I love that so much. So thank you for sharing. I want to take a shift a little bit because in several of your poems, you play with ideas of like dystopia. And especially, I think, and maybe now this sounds like a leading question, but like in the contemporary moment as well, too. So I wanted to hear you talk more about kind of like dystopia, the contemporary moment, and also like what it means to like sit and wrestle with that in particular.
Yeah, I always worry about fetishizing dystopia when I consider my location in the world in a global scale. And capital A N D and, because not, but, and I have only so much power and use a lot of it for people who are as close to the edge as I am. And so proportionately and what I'm able, what I feel like I'm able to do in like the world largely and in my personal life, like I sleep at night sort of just fine. You know, not worrying about like, oh, am I too privileged to talk about dystopia? Like, am I too first world to talk about dystopia? It's like, the chances that I got to be here. Wow. Cool. Random as fuck. And not to absolve myself. It's like, okay, so what is the closest end of the world for me? And that may not look like a certain kind of warfare. That may look like which one of my sisters is going to be killed this week. That's a different kind of dystopia. And I think that, like, I think when I think of dystopia, I think I oftentimes try to render it in a way where everyone is affected in a more, like, public conscious way. But there is a certain dystopia when you walk into a world where no one else around you is grieving but you. There's a certain thing where you, walk into, like, a space and you don't know who sees you as alive, as who you are, what that can mean for your safety, there are everyday dystopias for so many of us in so many various ways in so many various bodies. But when I think about it and when I think about how to render it, I want to pass off some of the anxiety I have. It's always an intentional, like, oh, you weren't worried about everything? Oh, let me give you something to worry about just for a sec, these 10 lines right here, stress the fuck out. And like, you know what I mean? Because it's sort of unfair to sort of oversell it in this one way. And so I try to either really oversell it to make it seem like fantastic and ridiculous, like in Intelligence, you know, and then it becomes this like absurd thing that can collapse back onto, no, things are really bad. Or I can make it very like ethereal and like bodily, like in, what's it called? Narcissus in Dystopia. But it still navigates that fear of surveillance, both being seen by people as a queen and also being literally watched from my computer. And so like that is a very personal dystopia. It's like, I both have to worry about being surveilled and I hope y'all fucking see me. You know, it's this thing that my dystopia feels very personal and I try to render it in a way that people can access both their own dystopias and the larger ones that we're definitely moving to.
Right. Yeah, I think one thing that I was thinking about while I was reading your book was just like the theme of looking, right? And like what looking means.
Yeah, I mean, I think about, I mean, this is sort of coming from my sociological background, but the sociological imagination sort of implies that like we have to use these sort of like variables and factors to extrapolate from any one thing we see, any one sample we see, and you know that's literally whatever the fuck it is. But when the ways that each of us extrapolate only reveal more about ourselves, and so I know that I feel like if I didn't talk about how anxious I was, my work would seem really cocky and entitled, you know, because I'm like, oh, y'all looking at me? Y'all looking at, but like, and unless someone could read through that and hear the anxiety, which people I think do, you know, people who perform that way similarly, but also like every time I talk about my work, and also I hopefully in my work, like I really want to make it clear that I'm like, oh yeah, I definitely believe that I am an alluring, some sort of whatever thing, which is why Narcissus is a great mole. Like Narcissus is literally divine. Like their mother is literally a nymph. It's not like a question that they have something special about them. They just can't know it. And so trying to like navigate I mean, how do I say this? And in a less personal way, like, oh, I'm not saying that I'm divine, but like there is a fetish and a need for like a black face, a trans face, a queer face. And so anything that I can like I can understand why someone would objectively want me or want my voice or something. But I also know that all that looking is going to cost. All that seeing still costs. All this representation still costs. And also someone looking at me does not ever necessarily correlate with loving me, you know, at all. So
So I wanted to have you read another poem. And the poem is The Future of Yesterday. And again, I was hoping you could read it and offer us some reflection and insight into it.
Yes. This is. Okay. I love this poem. Wait, is there more in the back? Oh, there is. Okay. A future yesterday. We was dancing like we could let all the breeze out our lungs. Sounded like a church, like the one down the road with no street lights, behind the second lot, then abandoned. The trees didn't scare us no more. We're no more blocks to burn effigy. Just all of us taking turns, smiling back and forth, a concert, a gathering across a main drag. You can smell the grass and gasoline and frying of peppers and grease. It didn't matter when you got there, just as long as you didn't miss the band in all white. A host of beatbox soul. There, the saxophone sweetened the bend in the back of our knees. We knew that the dust wasn't going to rise without our shuffle atop it. The earth finally swallowed all the graves into itself and sprouted wings and jean shorts and neon bodysuits riding around on technicolor bicycles. You couldn't see nothing but the crackling of the present. Couldn't hear nothing but the night, finally time unafraid of its shadow. The moon stopped boiling blood. Remembered how we all always been its creatures. And when the second sun rose, we sang to her too. Told her, thank you for the land again. All our blood been the keepers. This rapture was a home going back to ourselves. Didn't matter when you got there, as long as you didn't miss the generation of abandoned lots, sprouting streetlight revivals at the end of the world. Even the sea stayed quiet there, made way for our bones to again quake and holler. All this a joy. Damn. I haven't read the whole poem in so long. So I lived in Detroit for a little over a year. Which definitely changed. Well, thinking about dystopia for a bit. So I grew up in California. I was born between an earthquake and a riot. Like literally, that's literally when I was born. And then it's the state's always been on fire. For the last like 3 years, whenever I was returning to California, I would literally like see mountains on fire, like somehow, like whatever. And so so thinking about also like natural disaster as some kind of dystopia, I was literally born in like dystopia world. Like California is dystopic as fuck. Then moving to the East Coast is, you know, nor'easter. It gets snowy, but like it doesn't feel dystopic in certain aspects. Moving to Detroit was the best time of my life because Black people are amazing. But also the state has abandoned them in so many ways, and so like navigating like water advisories and there's like a house one block over from me, like just one night at midnight decided to go up in flames and no one, it just, you know, and it's just like the whole neighborhood's like, what the fuck's going on? So it wasn't anyone who was, you know, so things like that. And so the material contemporary dystopia felt much more tangible in Detroit. And then it recalibrated how I returned to the West Coast. And so now I re-see all of my home in on fire. So I'm like, oh, right. This is just our version of no water. Right. We just have, oh, right. Oh, right. Oh, right. Anyways. And not whatever. Anyways. And so this poem, was actually a combination of two things that I was trying to navigate. And so the first was, imagining like a heaven that felt a dystopic heaven, and like sort of like what can that concept mean, and it sort of felt like not even like having a heaven on Earth, but like a parallel dimension. It's just and so that was like something that I was trying to like navigate and write through, and then literally there was this like in the middle of the summer, this was like Detroit ass outside festival, like one block from my house. And like, I had like just moved to the neighborhood and like really needed so much. I needed so much. And I felt like I was really like alone in the wood. And this just like park of people just like living their lives in this band in all white of just like old school talented ass black women and one black dude on saxophone, just like killed it for like 3 hours. And I just, it really was like a spiritual experience. And also, growing up in LA, my world was like black and brown, very, very much so mixed in this way. But and so being like straight up like black high space, like in the dark with like all things, and there were so many cops around, but there's all this perimeter because all the to be a Detroit cop, you have to live in Detroit. So it's a really whole other weird, different, like not better, but just different relationship. So there was this like hyper like fortress like feeling, and so it felt really dystopic, but like really protected. It was so much. And so I had to capture just like, I'm like, oh, this is a kind of heaven. Like, I've never been here before, which I've been having before. I've never seen this shit before. And also it feels very as emotionally edifying. It feels so immaterial. So yep, this is a heaven. And so I wrote about like that night in one way, and they really began speaking to each other. So I really just, I just merged basically two sketches of poems. And now I can't tell you what was in what, but like there are things that are like narrative and like descriptive that are actually from that scene, but like those were just like little pops of like tokens, so of like the, you know, the general feeling. So yeah, the whole piece is now just a heaven, just a future yesterday.
Yeah. And I think too, I wasn't going to ask a question about this, but now that you said heaven, I've been thinking about that. So you mentioned there's like religious themes throughout the book as well too. And I was wondering, yeah, like, how do you think about heaven? How do you think about like what is oppositional to that?
Sure. You mean here where we are right now? This is great. No, I mean, I think my parents are both ministers. And I was raised in the church, and I do not have like a antagonistic relationship to Christianity per se. Full stop. Anyways, but in terms of heaven, I believe in other dimensions that we are freer and at more peace. If there is one dimension where we can collectively be, I think we can call that heaven. But I think we all live in such not even unfortunately, but like we can only ever understand so much about each other that I think it'd be more effective if we tried to understand personal heavens as opposed to a collective heaven. And I think that in our personal heavens, we can make space for other people to also feel that heaven. You know what I mean? And yeah, so when I think of heaven, I think of it as an immaterial place that we definitely need to be cultivating both in ourselves and for each other. But as some ultimate end goal, I don't think it's super necessary or useful because there's no opposite to it. We're here or trying to be in a better place. We can't. There's no third option in my mind.
That's great. Okay, so the last poem that I would love for you to read. I'll still leave it open. If you want to pick the poem, you can.
No, go for it. I love curation.
If you want to read like Narcissist Unplugged.
Yeah, this is actually like high key one of my favorites. And I didn't write it at the end of the collection. I wrote it somewhere in the middle. Yeah, like somewhere in like I want to believe it's in the first like quarter of the Narcissus that I wrote, actually. And then I almost put it at the beginning and put the demo at the end, but because of how it ends, let me read it and then I'll talk about it. Sorry. Let me read it first. Okay. Narcissus Unplugged. I worry I have romanticized loneliness. Sorry, I'm gonna start over. I worry I have so romanticized loneliness that the content with my reflection feels as much like a freedom as it does not. What if I truly wither away without touch? I turn everything into a poetic, but I imagine all of this is conceding defeat. I hide longing in a metaphor, and it becomes warm enough to rest in. But every desire can't blossom or shudder or wallow. Maybe I use my reflection as a distraction, make my own body a shimmering thing. Someone once told me the anthropological reason we as mortals admire jewels is because we are drawn to water and how light reflects. I have an obsession with precious things, so I fundamentally never love my body. We are not to look outside of ourselves for validation, but my reflection requires my full attention, lest I compare it to another. I'm so easily distracted by a luxury. I imagine everybody else has something I don't, but I have me. I have something somebody else desires. What if the only thing I can hold is myself? My best self is fleeting. I keep hoping the river will let me make sense of this vision. I was born to never know all I could become. Another poetic is using me for myself. I worry less about dying unknown than alone. I worry my worry is its own kind of arrogance. I'm just trying to see what everyone else does. I am more confused than enamored. I hope to die knowing my mystery will become myth. I wrote that. I needed, in case I ever forgot what Narcissus like was like the what like because the first one I the first Narcissus I wrote was Narcissus 17 because 17 is my number one, and so I start all my poem series with 17. It's my favorite number. And so that one was like absolutely desperate. That one I feel like I just tweaked it so it wouldn't be incoherent, but that one is so fever, anxiety, manic dream written in my head. And so I remember when I was writing this one, I was still in a different kind of bad place, but I was like, if this voice is going to be real, I need to like just like write seriously once, just like no like very little imagine like talk to this river, like, you know, like for like fuck the glamour, fuck the shit, like What are you afraid of? You know, and it was the most direct Narcissus that I wrote, because I feel like I really wrote it to me, in this like embarrassing way. Then it felt embarrassing, but I hope that if I could render it and let it be what it was, I could come here now and not be embarrassed by it, which thankfully I'm not. But that's even why I called it Unplugged, because I felt like it would have to be this like this version of Narcissus that is available for mishap and like this, you know, like yeah. Look, as opposed to like Narcissus single, you know, like it wasn't a single or whatever, or the bonus track, it was like Unplugged. And so like it was supposed to feel like, you're just here. Oh, you're just live with a guitar type shit, you know. You're just like with the mic in front of me, you know, vocalizing.
Thank you so much for reading that. And we're gonna wrap it up here in the next few minutes. So, I was hoping you could tell us kind of what your thoughts are now, and just general, and like where you see your work going next, and any projects that you really want to plug.
Cool. I've written a lot since I finished writing this book, and so I'm very excited for what I have sort of coming up personally in terms of my writing. I just finished a new zine called 17 Obligations that I'm going to self-release, that just like navigates some trans shit that's been bothering me in the world. But yeah, I'm more so proud of the work that I've been doing with Dev Song Labs. Check it out at devsonglabs.net. So I've been, well, myself and the phenomenal poet Logan February, we've been refashioning Winter Tangerine syllabi that I've written over the last 5 years, re-uploading them to a new digital archive. We've been hosting salons and readings here in Portland that we're going to be uploading. Streaming and recording video of salons and readings here in Portland that we're going to be uploading soon. But yeah, so it's really just a digital archive for writers to come in, get prompts, get lessons, see seminars, see talks. And we're going to be publishing a zine and broadside series this summer that I'm super excited about. But yeah, devsonglabs.net. Check that out. And then you can check me out. I talk a lot of shit on the internet, jdodd.net. Dayblxk, DeyBlxk, DeyBlxk on Instagram and Twitter. That's what I'm doing.
And where's the best place for
folks? Oh, yeah. You can get the Black Condition featuring Narcissus through Nightboat, nightboat.org, or you can go to my site, and there's a link right there that'll link you to the Nightboat link. If you go to jdodd.net, you'll look right there. It says the Black Condition featuring Narcissus. You can just pick it up.
Perfect. Okay, well, thank you so much. It was so great to have you on. You offered us such beautiful things. So I really hope the listeners are able to check it out and explore more of your work.
Yeah, thank you all so much for having me. Thank you for these great questions. I appreciate it.
Yes, have a good one.
Cool, thanks.